Hazel has one dream: to build a school for girls where any girl from any background could attend. But when the Earl of Bladenton walks into her office with his niece, she realizes that she is in danger of losing both her dream and her heart. I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. Today's novel will take us to Regency England with the first installment of Anna Bennett's Rogues to Lovers series, Girls Before Earls. Yes, that is the actual title. It's the title that sold me on the book in the first place. I didn't know anything else about it, and frankly, I didn't care. Girls Before Earls is the kind of play on words that I adore, so this was a purchase I was happy to make. If the list on Fantastic Fiction is to be believed, Anna Bennett has been writing historical romances since 2016. She has two trilogies, Wayward Wallflowers and Debutante Diaries, though I'm not sure if they'll gain additions as time goes on. Rogues to Lovers is her current project, though, and the next book should be coming out next January. But let's stick with what's in front of us, and that's Girls Before Earls. Our cover looks pretty typical for this genre. A woman in a Regency-esque gown holding a bouquet of flowers, looking out at the reader. Behind her is a gentleman, dressed in a Regency-esque coat, with his head tilted towards her, looking as though he is about to kiss her cheek or whisper in her ear. They look as though they're standing on a cliff overlooking a beach, the wind blowing the woman's dress and tossing a brown curl or two over her face. It is exactly what I would expect to see on the cover for historical romance. Nicely done, if not a little derivative. Inside, we begin our story with a flashback. A 9-year-old Hazel Lively has been brought to a school for girls, miles away from London. Her parents, a butcher and a seamstress, had died unexpectedly, and their neighbor was unable to take her in. So said neighbor had gathered what little money the family had been able to save, collected the girl, and brought her out to the school in the hopes that the headmistress would take pity on the girl's plight. No such luck, though. But since it was so late at night, the headmistress was willing to let them stay. Restless, grieving, unable to sleep, little Hazel crept into the headmistress's office in search of a book. She found books all right, but they had been collected into quite the mess. So Hazel did what any young neurodivergent book nerd would do. She began organizing. The next morning, as Hazel and her neighbor were getting ready to leave, the headmistress came out running after them. She asked if Hazel had been the one to organize the books, and Hazel admitted yes, she was, and then explained a little about what had been moved where. This was enough to convince the headmistress that Hazel would be worth the trouble taking in, so now Hazel had somewhere to stay. 19 years later, a now 28-year-old Hazel had moved into a town called Belhaven Bay. Here she began the task of building her own school, with one goal in mind: to welcome any girl of any status who had wanted an education. But to embark on such an endeavor, she needed students who had families that could pay the tuition, so that her school could be appropriately funded. She already had several students. And now in her office, she was looking at her next potential pupil, accompanied by the girl's brusque uncle. He introduces himself as Blade, Earl of Bladenton. Okay. This guy has way too many names. The blurb on the back cover calls him Gabriel. His niece calls him Beck. He calls himself Blade. Like, can we pick one, please? And I am not going to get started on Blade, Earl of Bladenton, because that is a whole bag of cats. But Blade has come to Hazel with a problem, namely his niece Kitty. She's been kicked out of two schools in less than 2 months, and she's more than happy to regale the mechanics of said expulsions to Hazel. Her uncle sends her out of the office to have a private word with the headmistress, to which Kitty responds that this is where he'll throw money at Hazel to be rid of her. Hazel is in a difficult position here. She needs money from wealthy families, so that she can support the students who can't afford it. She already had two such girls boarding at the school. The rest of her students lived in town with their families. But in order to gain wealthy clients, she needed a good reputation, and taking on a student who will do everything in her power to sabotage her education was not the way to gain acclaim. Blade's initial impression of Hazel was that of a prim and proper headmistress. So buttoned up that he couldn't imagine her having fun of any sort, but he was desperate. Kitty had lost her parents, his brother and his sister-in-law, and he knew that she needed an education. and he could also sense what it was that Hazel needed. He promised to pay Kitty's expenses, plus three times the tuition, and to sing the praises of Bellhaven Academy in his high society circles. A bit of back and forth, and Hazel agrees, but on the condition that Blade come and visit Kitty at least once every 2 weeks. Blade is taken aback by this, since he has to run his estate in London, and there simply isn't time. The only reason that I might give this guy a pass here is that traveling in the Regency era kinda sucked. For my own amusement, I actually looked it up. There is a Bellhaven Bay in the UK, and by car it's about a 7-hour drive. Now, is our book Bellhaven Bay the same as IRL Bellhaven Bay? I don't know, but it is a bit of a slog if your only transport is a carriage. Blade isn't interested in the imposition, so he decides that he won't be enrolling Kitty after all. He leaves the office to take her back to London, but Hazel's assistant, Jane, informed him that Kitty said she was going to get out to get some fresh air. Translation, Kit is making a run for it. They've no luck finding her in the immediate area. Blade thinks that she is off to find some trouble at the local pub, but Hazel surmises that a girl on a visit from London would be keen to visit the beach. They agree to search separately, all the while Blade insisting that he was correct. Along the way, Hazel sees a local resident of Bellhaven, Lady Rufflebum, and it's an excellent moment for us to see where Hazel is in terms of establishing her school, while showing that individuals like Lady Rufflebum aren't totally sold on her endeavor. Yes, I do love this name, and I will be saying it every opportunity. Eventually, Hazel is proven correct when she finds Kitty out at a place called Peacock Cove, out in the water in a sinking boat. Welp. Hazel takes no time getting into another boat and going out to get Kitty. That's about when Blade shows up, exasperated that Hazel had been correct, and frustrated that his plans for the night had been completely derailed. Plans being a soiree he had been invited to by one Miss Penelope. We'll have to come back to her. Hazel's rescue isn't going well. She's already lost an oar, and while she can swim, Kitty can't. And the poor girl is too frightened to move boats. At a loss, Hazel turns to Blade for help, who is already preparing to go out after them. Hazel gripped the oars harder and endeavored not to stare as the Earl strode into the water. His shirt hung open at the collar, revealing a swath of tanned skin. Wet buckskin trousers clung to his muscular thighs and narrow hips. When the waves slapped against his waist, he dove in and surfaced soon after, swimming through the surf with the ease of a dolphin. She'd caught glimpses of other men swimming in the bay, some of them wearing far less clothing than Lord Bladenton, but she never found any of them half as fascinating. They might hate each other now, but the hormones seem to be running wild. This does seem to be a theme with the haters-to-lovers trope, where they can't stand one another, but damn if they can't appreciate that view. Which, for the record, I really can't relate with. My brain doesn't exactly process attraction until it's got confirmation of a strong, safe emotional bond, and even then it's up in the air. So, in more ways than one, I feel a tad lost when I read some of these stories where the two mains are instantly drawn to each other like magnets. Again, I realize that these are romantic fantasies where the author has created a world where two people have found their perfect partners, so instant attraction usually comes with the territory. Even while Blade was exasperated by Hazel's conditions of Kitty's enrollment in her school, he had begrudgingly admitted that she could be pretty if she wasn't so buttoned up. The rescue goes as well as it can, but unfortunately, Hazel ends up in the water anyway. Thankfully, she is a strong swimmer and is able to make it to shore, lest she risk capsizing the boat and dunking all of them. As soon as Blade confirms that all of them are none the worse for wear, he tells Hazel that he's had a change of heart and will be enrolling Kitty after all, and he will also fulfill the promise of fortnightly visits. He leaves, still dripping with water, and Hazel convinces herself that her fascination with his perfectly shaped backside is due to her interest in science and biology. Whatever helps you sleep at night, I guess. The next day, Blade and Kitty arrive bright and early to see Kitty settled into the school. Hazel notes that the stiff and proper man little resembled the brief peek at the swashbuckling hero from yesterday. That's the book's term, mind you. Swashbuckling. Again, for my own amusement, I actually hit Wikipedia for the history of the term swashbuckler. and it's what it is on the tin. It's a stock character hero who rescues damsels in distress, defends his honor and his lady's honor with a sword, and protects those who cannot protect themselves. Very much an idyllic archetype. The swashbuckler tends to tie into the modern media conception of medieval times and chivalry and the golden age of piracy. It's not restricted to these cultural moments, though. The page lists notable swashbucklers in media, and it includes Lara Croft, Samurai Jack, and even Zuko from Avatar: The Last Airbender. But if I'm being perfectly honest, I don't see our dear Earl of Bladenton sliding into the swashbuckler trope. This might be a moment where definitions are varied between individual people, but Blade doesn't hit those notes for me. Right now, he's just a stuck-up Earl with a mysterious past that broke his heart, trying to find someone, anyone, who can deal with his niece while he courts a woman of high status back in London. So, just a typical dude. Sure, I might be splitting hairs here, but I have spent way too much time at Renaissance festivals to have anything other than high standards. Hazel shows Kitty around her dormitory, which is basically the attic room in the boarding house where she houses the students who don't have a home here in Bellhaven. Kitty's introduced to her new roommates, Lucy and Clara, and Kitty is already beside herself with the concept of sharing a room and doing chores. Welcome to reality, kiddo. A few days later, we catch up with Blade, sparring with a friend, and gathering up his courage to speak to Miss Penelope, who was rather cross that he'd missed her party. When he finally walks up to her, she is not letting him off the hook so easy. She knows what he wants, a respectable woman to call his wife, to run his house and raise his niece. She is up to the challenge, but she won't be humiliated by him, like he'd done when he'd missed her party. So if he wants to call her his countess, he'd better shape up, keep his niece in check, and court Miss Penelope properly. If he can toe the line well enough, she will allow him to announce their engagement in the fall. There are strict terms, but we have to remember this is Regency England. Marriage was a business transaction first, love never a guarantee. While we with our modern sensibilities might turn our nose up such treatment, it was to be expected here in this world. It might have been a little harsh then, but it also could have been par for the course. The day arrives for Blade's first visit to Bellhaven, and Hazel is happy to explain to him all of the antics that Kitty has been getting up to, including the traditional bedsheep rope escape attempt. He's horrified, of course, but Hazel shows no signs of kicking Kitty out of school. She summons Kitty, who is almost as reluctant, if not more, to spend time with Blade. As a last-ditch effort to make this trip not a total disaster, Blade asks Hazel to accompany them on their excursion.
I realize that an afternoon with your most troublesome student and her inept guardian doesn't hold quite the same appeal as your book, but I'm begging you to come. Please.
She blew out a long breath. 5 minutes ago, she'd have had no difficulty giving Lord Bladenton a firm no, but then he'd gone and shown a different, more vulnerable side of himself and left her feeling uncharacteristically persuadable. Almost, Lord help her, soft. She agrees to act as a buffer between uncle and niece and suggests a curricle ride on the beach, as shopping didn't seem to attract Kitty's current sensibilities. A curricle, by the way, is a light and open two-wheeled carriage usually pulled by two horses, probably the equivalent of a two-seater convertible car, fun and sporty. As it isn't a large carriage, the three of them have to squeeze in rather tight, and Kitty refuses to sit next to her uncle, leaving Hazel and Blade squished together. Blade is a gentleman, but it doesn't stop his male brain from being distracted by the touch of a lady. They all have a fantastic ride, though, and at Hazel's encouragement, Blade offers the reins to Kitty for a spell, who was thrilled at the opportunity. We don't see much else of their afternoon, but when Blade turns in for the night, he has a dream of the prim and proper Miss Hazel Lively. The next morning, Hazel is walking on sunshine, as it were. Thanks to the tuition that Blade had paid her, she's been able to pay for a good solid sum of the school's expenses for the rest of the summer, and she knew that the visit had done wonders for Kitty's mental well-being. The sunny mood is dashed, though, when Hazel gets a visit from one of her students' parents, Mrs. Covington. Her daughter Prue had been a wonderful addition to the school, but her mother worries that she'll pick up eccentric hobbies that might prevent her from catching the eye of a proper suitor. Hobbies like reading and painting portraits on the beach. Just tragic, I tell you. The situation is not helped when Hazel's landlady, Miss Paxton, came screeching into the office, complaining that the students had dressed up her cat in a gown fit to rival royalty. The cat didn't seem to be bothered, but Mrs. Covington doesn't think that exposing Prue to such antics will do her social standing any good. She's ready to pull Prue out then, right then and there, when Lord Bladenton arrives. He is all smiles and charm and doesn't hesitate to turn the eye of the contrite Mrs. Covington, who briefly reconsiders, or rather, makes no serious decisions while admiring Blade's behind. I swear this book is obsessed with Blade's butt. It's a little funny, if not odd. I don't think it's a typical part of these sorts of stories to focus on the butt of all things. Mrs. Covington leaves, and what follows is some banter between Blade and Hazel, discussing the merits of scientific study as it applies to charm, being charmed, and the practical study of biology. As a final experiment, Blade suggests that they kiss. Please let us be reminded that Blade is currently attempting to court the uptight Miss Penelope back in London, whom we could assume would absolutely lose her shit if she knew what Blade was getting up to. It takes a little convincing, but Hazel agrees, and Blade makes good on his offer. Her eyes fluttered shut, and her arms circled his neck. Her breasts pushed against the hard wall of his chest, and beneath her chemise, her nipples puckered. She'd always considered a kiss to be a relatively straightforward matter, the simple act of two people's lips coming in contact. But this kiss was infinitely more complex. It was the hot melding of their mouths and the desperate tangling of their tongues. It was a low growl deep in his throat, vibrating through her limbs. It was falling and floating and flying, all at the same time. In a lot of these romance novels, a kiss, while incredible, is usually just a kiss, and they can sometimes act as a barometer of what I can expect going forward. I'll admit to being surprised with this passage. The constant comments on Blade's butt were a bit raunchy, but I didn't think we'd get spice beyond what we'd see in some of the more sensual Harlequins. Then here comes this kiss, which gives us more than just kissing, of course. It's a hint that things will possibly heat up, so we'll have to see where it goes. As it so often happens in these historical romance novels, Hazel remembers what century she's living in and reminds herself that she is the headmistress of a finishing school, and the last thing she should be doing is kissing a man in her office. She and Blade both agree that the kiss was wonderful, but for their sake, Hazel says that they should forget it ever happened. Before Blade leaves, however, he asks for her given name, and despite herself, she tells him he can call her Hazel. Several days later, Hazel has taken the girls to some seaside cliffs to dig for fossils by the sea. Kitty is less interested in old rocks than she is in Hazel's relationship with Blade. Hazel denies that there is anything going on, and Kitty continues that she thought her uncle would end up with someone like Lady Penelope. Of course, this gets Hazel wondering who the heck that is, and when Clara asks, Kitty bites back, saying that Clara would likely never meet Lady Penelope, considering the latter runs in the highest circles, and Clara is a nobody. The moment feels inconsequential, just the girls and Hazel out on the beach, but it serves a purpose. It shows us the dynamics between all of these characters. While Kitty is still insufferable, she's learning to a point, and she does make an attempt at an apology. And Clara isn't particularly offended, and she's still happy to ask Kitty for a drawing. And that's how we get to see an actual development in Kitty's character, with her drawing skills. She likes to focus on buildings and castles, mostly. It might be a little cliché, the misunderstood ward with a beautiful artistic talent, but it keeps Kitty from being one-dimensional, so I certainly don't mind it. As they finish up for the day, they run into Lady Rufflebum, who invites Hazel to a dinner party that she is hosting. Hazel's reluctant at first, but she is worn down not just by Mrs. Rufflebum, but also her student and assistant Jane. Despite her motto, proper behavior never takes a holiday, she's set to enjoy herself Saturday evening. I will say, I'm getting some mixed signals with Hazel's approach to teaching. Yes, she's devoted to her work and the girls under her care, and she's presented as a very strict and proper headmistress. But that image doesn't exactly jive with the impression that I get from Hazel's methods. I'm not sure if the same headmistress who insists that proper behavior never takes a holiday would be the same woman who takes her students out to dig in the sand for fossils. She's already come into question with someone like Prue's mother, who wants something more traditional for her daughter. And one doesn't get the impression that a prim and proper finishing school would focus on being made available to even girls who can't pay for the privilege. I'm not saying Hazel's wrong. What I'm saying is, if she were the kind of headmistress that holds tight to proper decorum, I don't think we'd like her very much. As it is, I think this is a way to get us the impression that Hazel is a strict and dedicated lady boss who doesn't know how to let her hair down and needs a fun-loving Earl to loosen her bonnet. An Earl who has managed to snag himself an invitation to the very same dinner party. I mean, we all saw that coming a mile away. At the party, Hazel is introduced to everyone, including some, quote, eligible bachelors out here in Bellhaven. There's Dr. Gladwell, Viscount Dunmeyer, and of course, the Earl of Bladenton. Hazel is hoping that no one notices her heart is trying to beat its way out of her chest at the sight of the Earl, so she engrosses herself in the story being told by Dunmeyer about winning the regatta that's held in Bellhaven every year. It's a fierce competition, you see, and he has to keep up his win streak when the race is held next month. Before dinner can really get started, though, just as everyone is about to tuck into... Wait, what are they eating? Turtle soup? I guess it's historically accurate for the time, but it's a bold choice to stick in your narration. Anyway, Lady Rufflebum is giving a toast and promptly passes out. Good thing there's a doctor at the party. Dr. Gladwell and Hazel attend to their esteemed hostess, leaving everyone else to their dinner. They're not heartless, because as soon as she was able to, like the perfect hostess she is, Lady Rufflebum insisted that everyone stays. But that's not what happened. Once Hazel had Rufflebum settled, she returned to the dining room to see that it was empty, except for one guess. No points for guessing who. Blade insists on driving her to dinner, but at her refusal, he offers to take her straight back to the boarding house instead. She figures there's no harm in this, and, you know, she could talk about Kitty with him. It's business, after all. It's perfectly proper. She tells him about Kitty's drawings, which he wasn't aware of yet, and tells Hazel that, while Kitty isn't outwardly happy, she's not dour either, so things seem to be progressing well. Blade still doesn't like the fact that Hazel missed dinner, but she stands firm, knowing that if they're seen together, it could raise questions. It is still Regency England after all. Blade offers a compromise, a private dinner just on the beach, only the two of them. Hazel doesn't see the harm in this one either and was happy to oblige. Here's hoping Bellhaven doesn't have any spies. As they wait for their dinner to arrive, they open up a bit to one another. Hazel explains that she chose Bellhaven because of the ocean, and Blade describes his first and only love, Eliza. They'd been childhood sweethearts, but then she fell in love with someone else and moved away. Methinks there's something more here. As his story had been prompted by the question that there were only three people who had called him Beck, he went on. The third person, besides Eliza and now Kitty, was his brother, Kitty's father. And as we all know, he had died recently, leaving Kitty in Blade's care. Blade insists that after his hurt and loss, he's not particularly keen on being part of a family, though he'll do right by Kitty. He wants to live as he wishes, and poses the question to Hazel, doesn't she want to do whatever she likes? This moment of flirtation is interrupted by the arrival of their dinner, and they tuck in, all the while Blade being forward and flirty as ever. This guy is actually driving me a little nuts. He's technically courting another woman back in London, telling Hazel that he doesn't want anything serious, and he's constantly throwing himself at her. For me, I think this isn't exactly a good look for him. Penelope is often framed to be as unlikable as possible in order to justify Blade's wandering eyes, but in my opinion, those eyes are still supposed to be focused on Penelope. Blade needs to grow up and either commit to Penelope or understand that they won't be a good match and pursue Hazel properly, so long as she wants to be pursued. If he doesn't, this has a chance of ending very, very badly. For now, though, Hazel is happy to indulge in a bit of mischief, as she calls it, and they kiss at the end of their dinner. In the carriage, they get a little handsy, with Blade all the way up her skirt, and I do mean all the way. Alas, they arrive at the boarding house all too soon. Again, Hazel suggests that they forget it ever happened, but Blade isn't willing to give up so easily. So Hazel proposes to let things chill for 2 weeks, until his next visit to Bellhaven. If they still have feelings for one another, they can take it from there. Simple enough, I guess. There's two vignettes of life apart from one another. Hazel is allowing Kitty to get lessons from a local architect for her drawings, since the buildings seem to be her specialty. And Blade is having a visit with Lady Penelope. He says that they need to talk about their courtship, and she knows without him saying a word that there is another woman. He admits that while there are feelings, she's told him to move on, and Lady Penelope agrees. She's also not upset with him for this development. Blade had come to the same depressing conclusion as he'd lain awake in bed. He and Hazel could only end in heartbreak, and the last thing in the world he wanted was for her to feel the hurt and misery that he had. He would spare her that, no matter the cost. He dragged a hand down his face. "You might be right."
"Of course I am," Penelope said, utterly confident. "This is precisely why you need me, Bladenton. I can steer you in the right direction. I can tolerate your demons. And most important, I will never ask you for more than you can give."
From the outside, we can see that Penelope is offering a damn good bargain to Blade. She has an understanding of what he wants. However, in terms of her novel and character development, she is not what Blade needs. What Blade needs is to be able to move past his emotional trauma and allow himself the opportunity to love again. What he wants is to settle down with a proper woman and live his life as he chooses. On one hand, I might be able to argue that Penelope might be able to get him both situations, but I'm not sure. Of course, we know they won't end up together, not unless I've severely misjudged the genre. Blade might think that Penelope won't challenge him, but I'm willing to bet that she will, just not in the way that would be ideal for anyone. It's time for Blade's next visit to Bellhaven, and this time there's a cricket game at stake. It's locals versus tourists, and Kitty ropes Blade into playing for the tourist side. Hazel was invited to sit next to Lady Rufflebum, who was more than happy to tell her that the good Dr. Gladwell has been asking about her. If I didn't know any better, Rufflebum is trying to play matchmaker. The game goes like a cricket game, I've got no idea how it works, but then a stray ball heads straight for Lady Rufflebum. Hazel stands to protect her, and then both women go tumbling down. Dr. Gladwell orders them both back to Rufflebum's house so that he can look them over, and Blade says that he will be along soon to check on Hazel. Hazel is settled into a room to stay a while, waiting for the doctor, but when the door opens, it is not Dr. Gladwell, but Blade. How scandalous. Indeed, if they were caught like this, it would be the very worst, and Hazel says as much. Blade isn't worried, even when there's a knock at the door announcing the actual arrival of the doctor, so he dives under the bed to hide. Gladwell checks her over, declares no bones broken, but is she feeling feverish? Her pulse is racing, and her temperature is higher than it should be. Imagine that. He tells her that she is to rest here until the next afternoon, and if she needs anything, anything at all, to call on him at any time. Homeslice here is not being subtle, and Blade sure notices. When he emerges from under the bed after the doctor leaves, we get a little hint of his jealousy. But they could talk about it later that night. Good thing that Rufflebum offered to put him up while he was staying in Bellhaven this week, isn't it? Blade promises to return at midnight, and while he's waiting, he knows that something's changed between them. Watching the cricket ball hurtling toward Hazel solidified in his mind that the two of them are linked in a way that he never expected, and he wanted nothing more to protect her. When he sneaks into her room at last, he proposes marriage.
He thinks he's being romantic by telling her that he'll provide for her, but Dum Dum does it by saying that she wouldn't have to teach anymore. He does realize his mistake immediately, to his credit, and tells her that she could just move the school to London. You know, even though she said that she likes it being by the sea. See, he's thinking that he can get everything he wants. Hazel as his wife, and if she has a project to focus on, she won't make too many demands of his emotional commitment. He sees it as a win-win, I see it as pure stupidity. Thankfully, Hazel is wise to his pig-headedness. She knows that, yes, for now, she's falling in love, but a marriage where only one of them was in love was no marriage for her. It doesn't matter that she'd get his money, title, security. It's not what she would want. It seemed that neither of them could give the other what they needed, but they could offer each other a measure of comfort and more. They could give each other one night. One night to burn as brightly as they dared, so that years from now that they'd have a memory to pull from the distant corners of their minds. A rare, fragile memento that they could dust off and hold up to the light in order to glimpse a fraction of its former brilliance. She wanted that. For Blade and for herself. After double and triple checking for her consent, the smartest thing this idiot's done the whole novel, they have a good tumble in the hay. As I mentioned before, I was expecting a spice level around the Harlequin metric, but I was pleasantly surprised here. Now, it is by no means as filthy as American Queen from the last two episodes, but it's not chaste either. We don't get explicit descriptions, but certainly we're getting some healthy visuals for sure. The next morning, Blade is hopeful that his dick was magical enough to get her to change her mind about marrying him, but no such luck. He worries that if there might be a baby, but Hazel promises that she'll let him know if she becomes pregnant. Gosh, if this does end up with a pregnancy, I certainly hope that Hazel has the access to care and support that she needs to make any choice that would be the best for her in her current situation. Kitty has given her uncle word that she and the other students would be putting on scenes from a play, specifically Romeo and Juliet, so Blade finds himself in Bellhaven early for his visit once again. Unfortunately, it's also the same day as the regatta race, and Blade is being pressured into joining. This won't be the kind of story where he has to choose between the two. It's at different times, thank goodness. So Kitty is excited when he accepts an offer from Dr. Gladwell to join his team. There's another character in this book, a girl named Poppy. She's not a student with Hazel, but she borrows books and such. She's the daughter of a fisherman and had been giving Kitty swimming lessons. She was meant to be racing in the regatta, but her partner was a no-show, and as a last-minute change, Kitty steps up to the challenge. In a perfectly predictable outcome, Kitty and Poppy win the regatta, while Blade and the Viscount end up in a brawl. It's rather silly, but endearing all the same. At the end of the race, Hazel congratulates Kitty and Poppy and watches in horror, as who would show up but the famous Lady Penelope. She is reeling while Penelope marks her territory on both Blade and Kitty, and Hazel has no choice but to offer an invitation to see Kitty's play when she goes fishing for one. I'm sure I've expressed this before, but I am most certainly not a fan of the catfight. Not every story needs a villain, and if romance novels must have a villain, I prefer one that didn't make the lovers have to fight for their attention. After the play, Penelope goes to thank Hazel for the invitation and expressing all her gratitude at all that she's done for Kitty. Telling Blade that she will see him at the mayor's dinner party that evening, she throws one final barb by informing Hazel that Kitty won't be returning to Bellhaven after the summer. With that, she leaves and Hazel is astounded. She can't bear their heartbreak any longer and tells Blade that whatever they had between them was over and that their relationship was purely business from now on, for as long as Kitty remained at the school. They part ways and Hazel collects herself so that she could face Jane and her students with dry eyes. The hits keep on coming, though. After talk about the upcoming summer ball, Bellhaven's premier social event, Prue's mother, Mrs. Covington, informs Hazel that watching Kitty compete in the regatta solidified her choice to remove her daughter from the school. She has to keep up her daughter's reputation, you see, and no respectable man would marry a girl who thought sailing in regattas was an appropriate activity. At a complete loss, Hazel fears the worst. She worries that with the loss of one student, other parents would follow suit, and she wouldn't be able to continue teaching. But one thing could help matters. If perhaps Lady Penelope could take Prue under her wing, introduce her to the proper people in the Tun, then Mrs. Covington might be able to change her mind about her daughter's prospects. But in order to make that happen, she has to talk to Blade. She meets up with Blade in secret, lest that they be seen together again, and explains her problem. He offers to become a financial sponsor, but she declines. Not only would she be risking further anguish being in close proximity to him, she is determined to remain financially independent. He then offers to take Kitty out of her school, perhaps allowing Miss Covington to return without worry. Again, Hazel declines. She won't sacrifice one student for the sake of her whole school. Blade promises to get Penelope's help in saving Prue's education and, in turn, saving Hazel's school. And then, with high emotions, Blade can tell Hazel's got some certain kind of feelings in this exact moment, but no sex. Oh, no. Instead, Blade wants to watch her pleasure herself. Alone on that beach, he leans Hazel back against his chest, and while he whispers sweet encouragement in her ears, Hazel does as he suggests, masturbating until she reaches climax. Again, pleasantly surprised with this development. We don't see much of this sort of thing, so it's good that we found it here. The next day, Blade's taken Penelope out for tea at a local tea shop, where he makes his request. Please, introduce Prue to the right people, and perhaps even mentor her for her first season. Blade tries to play it off as something for Kitty, because Prue and Kitty are solid friends, and Bellhaven will continue to thrive, and thus, so will Kitty. Penelope isn't stupid, though. She knows that he's doing it for Hazel, but she is amicable on two conditions. First, Blade must never speak to Hazel again. As his future wife, she will be more than happy to cover all of Kitty's educational needs, including dealing with Miss Lively. And second, they will publicly announce their engagement next week at Lady Rufflebum's summer ball. Blade has no choice but to agree. Back at the academy, emotions are high, and there is some drama between Kitty and Hazel, mostly surrounding a missing book and a borrowed handkerchief. Kitty runs off, and Hazel finds her at Poppy's place. Amusingly, Poppy had the book in question, completely by accident, and Hazel and Kitty are able to reconcile. During their conversation, she sees Kitty with a locket, containing a portrait of her parents, and that is how Hazel learns the name of Kitty's mother, Eliza. What a coincidence, that the only woman Blade ever loved was named Eliza, and here was a woman named Eliza who had gotten married to Blade's brother. The plot thickens. Together, Hazel, Kitty, and Poppy make a small secret society together, the Bells of Bellhaven Bay. There were three rules: listen to each other, support each other, and to always chase their dreams. It's that night Hazel decides that she wouldn't tell herself no any longer, to chase her own dreams, so she runs off to London to find Blade. She's able to meet with him as discreetly as they can manage, and she admits to him that she knows about Eliza. He tells her the full story, how he'd fallen in love, and how he'd found his brother in his bed with the woman he loved. He never spoke or saw either of them again, not until he saw them lying dead in their home after the carriage accident. Having relived the worst days of his life, he didn't feel as though he could risk losing his heart again. But Hazel understands him better now, and tells him that she loves him. She doesn't expect him to respond, but she does want to give him a parting gift. He ran his hands over her body, committing every curve to memory. He tangled his tongue with hers, savoring the sweet, slightly spicy taste of her. She kissed him with an abandon that thrilled him. She nipped at his lip, raked her nails down the back of his jacket. "I don't have much time," she murmured against his mouth, even as she slipped her hand inside his trousers and wrapped her fingers around him. Hazel gives him the best head of his life, and it's after that he explains the deal that he made with Penelope. Well, at least Hazel's informed now, I guess, but he wants to do the right thing and remove himself from his arrangement. There's just one problem with this plan. He is engaged to Lady Penelope, who is not willing to let him go and tells him so. She doesn't care what he wants, but she wants what she has been planning on. Later, we catch up with Hazel as she reads a letter from Blade, giving her a proper goodbye. It's the night of the ball, and while it's not exactly a charity event, I feel as though it can qualify for the it's time for a fundraiser trope, if only because there's a lot about to go down at this party. If we thought that this was going to go without a hitch, we are all delusional. The girls all get together to doll up Hazel. Kitty loans her some earrings gifted to her by her parents, and then they all present her with a dress that they'd altered just for her. Blade and Penelope arrive at the ball, and Blade attempts to negotiate. He hands her a letter that can be sent immediately in order to announce their engagement in 3 days' time. That way he won't be able to back out of their bargain. And as Lady Rufflebum takes deep pride in her yearly event, he doesn't want to upset their hostess. Penelope isn't playing, however. She denies his request to send the letter, taking it from him, saying that Rufflebum is expecting something exciting to happen tonight, and if he won't announce the engagement at midnight, she will do it for him. After that, when Hazel arrives, Penelope meets up with her, asking to speak in private. She tells Hazel that she knows what she has been up to, and if Hazel does anything to interfere with her engagement, Penelope will spill the beans. This would effectively destroy Hazel's reputation, and thus the reputation of Bellhaven Academy, and she is not above nuking Hazel's life from orbit to get what she wants. Charming woman. As the night goes on, it seems that the girls of Bellhaven have conspired a plan of their own. Through some subterfuge, they manage to first lock Blade and then Hazel into the greenhouse, and then the two have no other choice except to face one another and talk it out at last. Hazel tells him what Penelope had said to her, and he promises he won't let it happen. After their failed attempt to escape the greenhouse, where he had tried to climb out a window, Lady Rufflebum has come along to open the door, and of course she's got a crowd with her who can all see the strange circumstances that find Blade and Hazel together. Blade does right by Hazel. He truthfully explains that he tried to escape from the greenhouse, and that nothing had happened between him and Hazel. He goes further to endorse her school publicly. Hazel decides that she is in for a penny, in for a pound, however, and says that while she's devoted to her school, there are more important things, like her girls, her family, and love, admitting her love for the Earl. Penelope pipes in, making it look like poor Hazel was caught in a one-sided relationship, and encouraging Blade to make his announcement, which leads to her surprised Pikachu face when Blade admits that he is also in love with Hazel. He asks her to marry him, and this time she accepts. Because we need more drama, Penelope goes to reveal the letter Blade wrote for their announcement, but she can't find it. That's when the Viscount Dunmeyer walks up, says that he found the letter as Penelope was busy in Rufflebum's silver closet. The letter is no more, as he destroyed it. Why? Well, he wants Penelope to marry him instead. Okay. With that, the dragon is vanquished, so to speak, and it looks as though our couple is going to live happily ever after. Just to be sure we know, Blade and Hazel sneak away for some post-proposal sex. Our story ends as we watch Hazel attend to the number of new enrollments the school was attracting, thanks to Blade's speech, and Blade telling her about the property he wants to buy here in Bellhaven so that they can build their perfect home. It's a sweet ending for sure, if a little outlandish with that ball. But today's novel was another one of those that defied expectations. I wasn't sure I would get anything more than the typical historical romance, but I found some unexpected moments inside. To really get into it, let's go over Heather's final score. First, for the cover, it is a 3 out of 5 for me. It's not horrible, not like some covers we've seen, but it doesn't stand out either. If anything gave me that expectation of the typical historical romance, it was the cover for sure. I will say that I did appreciate how they overlaid the title to fit within the woman's flowing skirt, so that was a nice touch. Next, drama is about a 3 out of 5. There was enough tension between our two main characters that I wasn't exasperated by the silliness of it all, but some of the plot points raised a few eyebrows. Namely, the scene at that final ball. Very much a rom-com sort of ending. Romance will get us another 3 out of 5. Again, it's pretty middle of the road here. I thought the two of them had good chemistry, but I was turned off by the fact that Blade was actively courting two women at once. And while he wasn't emo to the point of resembling a certain sparkling vampire, he kept stringing Hazel along with his flirtations. Now, he isn't alone here. Often it was Hazel who initiated their sexual encounters, but she wasn't the one with an understanding with another suitor, now was she? Spice will get a surprising 4 out of 5. Again, it's nowhere near the insanity that was our last book, but it still stood out enough that it rises above most of the romances that we've read. While not vividly descriptive, it gave us some usually unseen scenarios, such as the scene where Blade encourages Hazel to touch herself, so it gets a solid thumbs up for me. Finally, realism is another middle of the road with a 3 out of 5. There are aspects that worked for the novel, such as the arrangement between Penelope and Blade as an obstacle. It fits right into the historical romance genre. And while Hazel was a convincing headmistress, she had moments that were meant to soothe our modern feminist sensibilities. It's a situation where any one thing could easily happen, but altogether it creates some chaos. But at the heart of it, this novel was a delightful read. If anything, this is the exact kind of book we'd expect to read for the summer. I might have my own personal reservations, but this wasn't a bad book. Quite the contrary. I found myself cheering right along when Penelope was thwarted at the end and when Blade and Hazel could have their happy ending. So for my final score, Girls Before Earls will get 4 pseudo-swashbuckling Earls out of 5. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Yun Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.